Hi, and welcome back. I'm Patrick Polk, and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. The Rules of Investing gets inside the minds of leading investors, economists, and industry experts, and it's brought to you by Livewire Markets. Today's guest is Mike Hill, Managing Director and Portfolio Manager at Bombora Group. Mike has a long history of investing in private companies, having joined private equity firm Ironbridge Capital back in 2004. In 2016, he helped found Bombora Group, which invests in both pre-IPO growth companies as well as small cap growth companies on the ASX. The Bombora Special Investments Growth Fund returned a massive 52.9% in 2019, making it one of the best performing funds in the country. We discuss some of the similarities and differences between working in private markets and public markets, one little-known company that he believes could one day be a large cap, and we take a dive into a case study of a company that he's taken from private to public. We look at the initial investment, the journey so far, and what the future looks like. Before we get into the show, I want to let you know that Livewire Markets has recently launched a new podcast called Buy, Hold, Sell. If you're a Livewire subscriber, you should be familiar with Buy, Hold, Sell already, as we publish the series every Friday in video format. Well, Buy, Hold, Sell is now available in a podcast format, which you can access through Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Buy, Hold, Sell features two fund managers who each offer their view, buy, hold, or sell, on a selection of well-known and relevant stocks. If you're an Apple Podcasts or Spotify user, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so that you don't miss an episode. Or if you're a Livewire subscriber, hit the follow button at the bottom of the wire to be notified whenever I post content. Not a Livewire subscriber yet? Just head on over to livewiremarkets.com. It's free, easy to register, and you'll get access to insights from the leading investment minds in the country. Well, that's it for now. I hope you enjoy the show. Mike, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to get to know you a little bit first and just hear a little bit about your background. I know you made a move from previously working in private equity and venture capital, and now you run a strategy that kind of straddles both public and private markets. Could you tell us, first of all, what was it that actually kind of triggered you to make that move, and what have been some of the similarities and the differences that you've observed?
Yeah, sure. So my background, you know, I originally came through the whole chartered background, getting into advisory, working for Ernst & Young, actually in their entrepreneurial advisory team on, transactions where either founders or management were trying to buy, sell, or private equity or venture capital were trying to invest into certain companies. That's kind of how I sort of worked my way from, you know, that typical chartered background into sort of investment advising, and then ultimately into private equity, where I became on the, you know, on the buy side, investing the fund's money into, you know, business opportunities. I think the move, you know, was really good. I was a partner at Ernst & Young, and when I told my folks that I'd just shifted to this fund called Ironbridge, they said, "Who the hell's Ironbridge, and why would you give up a partnership at Ernst & Young for?" So, but, you know, that was a long time ago. Back in the early 2000s, I joined Ironbridge. Ironbridge was a domestic typical buyout fund. The first fund we had was a $450 million fund. It's quite different to the strategy we run today with the way the fund itself is structured. So a private equity fund typically would be a 10-year closed fund. So you invest that $450 million in, say, the first 5 years, and you exit all the investments in the last part of the fund. It's not always exactly that linear, but that's kind of the concept. And usually by the time you're about year five or six, you're looking at raising the next fund and then starting to invest the next fund's money. So our second fund at Ironbridge was $1.05 billion. So pretty big funds. We would buy 100% of a company that might have a value somewhere between, on the small end would have been 100 million, on the bigger end it could have been, I think the biggest one we did was 850 million. You would run the company with the management team for the next sort of between 2 and 5 years and then look to exit it either by IPO or trade sale. The strategy we have now follows a lot of those disciplines from private equity. So we do exactly the same thing where we look at opportunities, we screen the opportunities, we run due diligence on the opportunities. Ultimately, we make a decision to invest or not. But once we've made that decision to invest, that's kind of day one. And then the story really evolves over the next, you know, 2 to 5 years, the same as what we did in private equity, and that is working with the management teams, working with the founders, the entrepreneurs, helping them with their growth strategy in the business, helping them get the right organisational chart across the management team within the business opportunity. When we take these businesses from private to public, you know, we obviously take them through the process of listing. We work with the brokers, the investor relations people, and all the stakeholders, the fund managers that typically would invest in these sorts of businesses. So on one sense, it's the same investment decision, the same process to grow these businesses from what you would have done in a private equity fund to what we now do with the Bombora Special Investment Growth Fund. But it's a matter of sort of straddling the private market and the public market, which makes it a little different. And I guess the other obvious difference between a big traditional domestic buyout fund like Ironbridge to what we're doing now is it's all about growth capital and equity. We don't put leverage into the smaller growth technology deals. It's all about working with the guys with the right capital structure and giving them that growth capital to, you know, hopefully build their business from a, you know, what might be a $20 million business into a $200 or $400 million business.
I have no doubt that you meet with a lot of business founders and CEOs and managers. I imagine it's probably a pretty big part of your job from day to day. In your experience, what actually separates the successful founders from those who found businesses that end up failing?
Yeah, it's a good question because I don't think there's a straightforward answer for you know, someone that tries hard but the business just doesn't get off the ground. I think what we really look for is, you know, critically you're always investing behind a management team. So you've got to make an assessment on how good the team is and are they capable of taking the business from, you know, point A to point B. I think it also goes down to the types of business you invest in. We try to find businesses that have deep technology. So when I'm talking about that, I'm talking about companies that have embedded software systems that become, they don't always need to be mission critical, but they need to be really important and value added to the customer. Why does a customer want to use the actual technology? Because the stronger that link is, the better chance you get, you have those recurring annuity revenue streams that can underpin, you know, a small business that's growing fast. And I think it's the managers and entrepreneurs that are able to move into a space with a product and capture the strength of their revenue streams through this sort of deep technology and embedded value that's really needed at the end of the day by the customers, usually on a business-to-business basis is what we look for. But, you know, hard to see why some people fail. Obviously, if you're a business taking on three huge, you know, mega companies in the same industry, you know, you've got to say to yourself at the start, this is going to be a hard road. But sometimes if they're disrupting in the right way, there could be pretty interesting journeys to try and get on.
Looking at your process, you, the first phase after you've identified a deal is what you call phase one screening. I was wondering if you might be able to break that down for us a bit and maybe tell us what are some of the attributes that you're looking for in a successful investment and what are some of the attributes that you'd actually like to avoid?
Yeah, sure. The screening is really important. It actually consumes a lot of our day. I mean, we're actually lucky enough, I guess, to now have a network of 10 guys in our fund that all have over 20 years experience. So the amount of deal flow coming in, when I say deal flow, I mean the investment opportunities that come to us is amazing, the quantity of opportunities of businesses that are seeking that sort of growth capital round. So the most important part is, when you're getting two or three deals a day coming into the business, you need to work out pretty quickly what you're looking for and how you screen what, you know, might consider the good deals from those that, you know, don't tick all the boxes. And I guess we're lucky enough, you know, when we have that level of deal opportunities come to us, we can screen them pretty hard. And so, you know, we're clearly looking for, you want to tick all the boxes. Everyone wants to tick all the boxes for a good investment. But you can look at the revenue growth. You can look at the ability for the revenue to fall through to the bottom line, because investors like growth, but they also at some point like to see that it become profitable growth. Profitless growth is not really something that really gets you there at the end of the day. But as long as you can see the money you're investing back into the growth, one day will become, you know, profitable to the bottom line. So we clearly dissect the revenue really well and look for that sort of annuity level rather than sort of project level, if you like, or contracted level. We look at the dynamics of the industry where these businesses fall. So, for example, education technology is an interesting one. Do you want to sort of invest in a company that's, let's say, in classroom learning, where there's many different applications being provided to schools and higher education bodies? Or do you want to get into a business that has something a little different that others don't necessarily have? And, you know, I'll use the example, just because we've got it in our fund, of course, of a company called Janison Education. And Janison Education is really solving a simple problem. Everyone can think of their kids, you know, whether they're, you know, going through school or university, or even people going through some form of accreditation course. You tend to learn everything these days on computers and, you know, electronic environments. But then when you get to an exam, you put all the computers away, you get your pen and paper out, and you actually write your exam. And there's every school in the world and every university in the world is talking about at some point they go digital for their examination process. But there's only so many companies that actually offer that robust, secure platform that can enable a high-stakes exam to be conducted, not be, you know, hacked into, and, you know, is stable enough to make sure that you don't go through halfway through an exam and everything collapses. So it's a big, you know, point. It's really important to education professionals everywhere. And Janison is one of the few companies that's actually built that sort of platform. So from building, you know, a platform for the OECD globally to basically digitally test 15-year-old students in different countries all over the world for the education standards of one country to the other, or potentially within regions of one country, through to building year 12 digital exams for the Singapore government. They built the NAPLAN platform for the Australian government. So you look for industry dynamics where you can see there, yeah, that's really important, there's a need, and you can see why there's growth. Management I talked about before, the culture of the business is super important. You don't want to sort of invest in behind managers that have a sort of a, you know, aggressive bullying, you know, don't really want to listen to their team, because I think team environments in these smaller sort of growth businesses are super important. Sustainable models, scalable models. Clearly, you look at the valuation of the company that you're looking at and the valuation in comparison to its peers that may be traded or peers that have been transacted, sold, you know, in the past. You sort of try and capture everything when you can.
I wanted to get into some of the detail around one of your investments, and I want to get fairly deep into an example. So what I might do is we'll probably break this question up into a few parts. I want to really get inside this investment. So let's start with, could you pick one of your investments, one that you've held since it was a private company, pre-IPO, has since listed? And let's start with, could you tell us what was the research that you did initially before you invested?
Okay, yeah. So as I said before, we've taken two companies from private to public within our fund. So I'll talk to one of those two examples. I guess the one that we spent the most time on from a pure private business to taking it through public was a company called Pacific Knowledge Systems. I mentioned it earlier. Pacific Knowledge Systems is a healthcare software application that is sold to pathology operators. So think of a pathology customer. They run a huge lab or a series of labs, and they run their core business on a lab information system. It measures everything from the patient's, you know, referral into the test that's required or requested, making sure they control the test through the process, through the various machines, depending on whatever test is happening, and then ultimately the report that goes back to the specialist doctor or the GP. So we were presented with this as an opportunity to invest in, and I just sort of dart back to my Ironbridge days where, you know, I was lucky enough for the team to have done quite a lot of investing in healthcare. So I had a good start on this one. So this was a pathology software application. So my first point of call was to go back to the CEO of a hospital business we bought. We bought 54 private hospitals from Main Group back in the early 2000s, and we ultimately sold that company to Healthscope and Ramsay. But I went back to that CEO because the CEO we continued to invest in. We also created IVF businesses. Monash IVF is a listed company. That came out of a similar sort of management team originally when we started that investment. So I was able to go back into industry executives and say, hey, I come across this pathology software application, and they actually sell that application to your old hospital company, and your pathology division of that hospital company actually uses the product. So it was a pretty good and obvious point to start. So this is part of our, you know, diligence, if you like. So I sat down with Robert Cook, who was the CEO of Healthscope. He was private prior to that. He was the CEO of the hospital business we bought, and he was also involved in that IVF business. So over the years, I'd known Robert really well, and I respect his views. And so Robert said, okay, so you're looking at pathology. Let me get the head of pathology from, you know, one of your customers in, and we'll have a talk to him. So we did that, it was really interesting that the head of pathology came in, and we sat down, the three of us, and we talked about this application. And, you know, they were both saying, you know, it's clearly got value. It clearly fits within the customer's needs. It does move towards a sort of mission critical stage. What this application actually does is it's a knowledge base. They call it, the jargon in the industry is clinical decision support. So what that means is the lab does the results for the patient. The data from that patient is fed across the knowledge base, this clinical decision support tool. This is our IP in this company. And it allows the pathologist to make a determination on what he sees from the test results. He writes that determination into our application, and it captures that piece of knowledge. So next time you see the same results coming from a different patient, the system is now starting to automate the most likely result for the various test results. So that creates efficiencies in a public or private pathology operator. And these days, pathology companies compete pretty fiercely for the volume, and so they have to be efficient with the way they apply their scientific and pathology costs back into getting the reports for the tests back to the doctors. So anyway, back to talking to Robert about this opportunity, Robert Cook. Both Robert and Anoop both said, this is a great application, but you know, if you really want to understand the technical benefits of this particular application, why don't we get Paul Williams involved? And Paul used to be the chief information officer of Healthscope. So a great guy to sort of, you know, round out exactly how does this product integrate with the core lab information system? Does it interfere from a technical point of view? Does it add value? Do they need to spend money on it? So we actually asked Paul to do a level of due diligence for us. And that was go away, interview a bunch of the customers, interview a bunch of pathology operators and hospital operators that don't use the product, see why they don't use the product, see whether they would use the product, and come back and report to us on, does it need money spent on it? Does it add value? Do they use it effectively? Ticking all the boxes for why you might think that application is good or bad. Well, the summary of that report was, yes, it ticks all these boxes. It's really interesting. And Paul said, how do I stay involved? And we said, okay, I like that idea. So why don't we get you involved in a board of the company? So we listed the company, and now Paul Williams is a non-executive director. Now that means he understands intimately how these hospital systems and pathology systems all actually fit together. And he understands how these various applications like Pacific Knowledge Systems actually integrates into these core systems. It can also give us a clear view on how we expand the business and, you know, some of the tricks in how you approach healthcare companies, both in the private and the public domain. So that's the kind of level of diligence we went to even before we made a decision to invest 1 cent in the opportunity.
No investment ever goes exactly as you expect it to the whole way along your journey. I'm sure you've probably faced a few challenges along the way. Could you tell us a little bit about some of those challenges?
Yep, sure. That's why we have a portfolio, because, you know, as much as people wish businesses to point north forever, they don't. They go through their ups and downs. And, you know, a big part of our job is, when you're sitting on boards working with management teams, is, you know, making decisions and fighting fires when, you know, things don't always go according to plan. So, you know, over the years, that, you know, both at Ironbridge and outside, I've been involved in a number of sort of, you know, big decisions that you need to make, whether you've got to downsize the business, change the direction of the business, change the management team in a business, add to the management team, all those sorts of things. So, you know, we've had a couple of examples where we've changed managers, CEOs of the business, you know, sometimes because they just said, look, this is not for me anymore, and sometimes because other stakeholders in the business had determined that, you know, there was time for a change, or the business has grown to a point where you needed to bring in, you know, new ideas, etc. And that always presents a problem. It's not a simple thing just to say, hey, we're going to hire on, you know, a new CEO into the business. It's a very careful decision, especially when you're public. The public markets wants to know that a change in a key man, a woman in a business is managed the right way. And I think that's, you know, to be an effective board, you need to make sure that you bring everyone with you in the story for why there is change. It's also pretty hard to find the right person to replace that person if you're in that situation. So I think we've had a fair bit of experience in dealing with the executive recruitment agencies to help screen, you know, various executives that put their hand up for an opportunity, and try and work out whether you pick the best replacement for a change like that, because that is, you know, a big decision in a business that might not be going in the right direction.
So how's the investment gone for you so far? Obviously, it's listed now. Has the journey been broadly a pretty happy one up till today?
Yeah, so the Pacific Knowledge Systems, the investment's going well. From an operational point of view, people look at it from the outside and they don't know what level of work we're doing on the inside. So we're literally, before this podcast, I was at a board meeting for that particular company going through their half yearly results releases, and we're talking about the, you know, the way in which we need to talk to the, you know, the achievements and highlights of the business in the last 6 months. And we try to articulate exactly what the growth strategy is of that business, so someone from the outside can understand exactly what we're doing on the inside. So we're building our direct sales force to tackle, you know, more direct customer opportunities. We're building our internal resource to improve the ability for us to work with our existing customers to expand the use of the product in their current business. We're working with our international channel partners on how they can grow the business and how we can yield, you know, financial benefits from them distributing our product overseas. And we're also looking at, you know, acquisitive growth strategies. You know, what are the right sort of options that you can take a small business and scale the business up through selective synergistic acquisitions? And so we do a fair bit of that sort of work as well on all these smaller growth businesses.
And the final part of this little case study, which is, of course, the most important part, what does the future look like for that company? Where do you see the company moving over the next 2-5 years?
Yeah, so right back to the start of why you would want to invest in it, when we did that diligence that I was talking about before with the management team and understanding how important it was, we also understand the market opportunity for that business. And so we do see this business being many times bigger than what it is today. It's about us executing on those growth strategies I was just talking to. So we've invested in the business probably 9 months ago. It's been listed for less than a year. This is definitely a 3-year plan, because health sales cycles are long. And so what you need to do is have all the right information and rationale as to convince these, you know, think of a public, you know, state health authority. They take a long time to make a decision to take on a new software application. But once you get it into that authority, they'll continue to use it forever. And so it's a bit about that sort of long-term strategy in delivering, making sure we get the right international accelerating growth strategies with our channel partners, and, you know, delivering these sort of synergistic acquisitions along the road as well. So, you know, our view is definitely we didn't list the business, and that's our exit point. That's actually our entry point. We invest before the company's listed, we invest again when the company lists, And we'll also invest behind the company when it's going through any sort of fundraising process, whether it's for an acquisition or even organic growth, you know, needs if it wins big customers and it needs, you know, money to do something to the product, et cetera. So our time frame is definitely 3 years on that one minimum. We're sort of less than 1 year into the journey, and we certainly see that business being a lot bigger in the future.
Well, before we move into my favorite questions, which we ask all of my guests, I did have one more for you, a little bit focused on growth and revenue, which I know is something, well, we all love growth in revenue, but looking across your portfolio today, public, private, wherever, what company do you see as being, you know, most likely to be a large cap stock? What do you see being just having that huge opportunity there?
Yeah, I might pick one of our private investments now, because, you know, who knows what the future holds for these things. They're not listed at the moment, so no one can dive onto the ASX and grab at all their information. But this is a really interesting business that was brought to us by one of the brokers. Wilson's Advisory brought it to us. They brought it to us because they came across this business, and the founders and previous shareholders were quite keen to list the company, but it was just a bit too early to list. They presented the company to us, and we said, wow, that's a pretty niche sounding business, but tell us more. So this company actually builds the digital imagery scenery for flight simulators. So you might go, okay, flight simulators, what does that mean? So there's about four major flight simulators available in the world. And Lockheed Martin, for example, is one of the players that builds a flight simulator. And when you use their flight simulator software, usually what you see on your screen where you're flying around is pretty average imagery. What our company does is builds lifelike scenery, like, for example, it could be Melbourne city landscape. It could be some beautiful airport in the Swiss mountains that you can practice landing on. We've launched the south, mid and north regions for the UK. So we build either airports, cities or regions in this digital scenery format. And they're amazingly accurate. Every building's been modelled by these developers that are spread all over the world. We have guys in Poland and South America and the UK that sit in their hobby and passion is to build these amazing looking cities and airport profiles so it's exactly like it is. Anyway, this business, I'll give you a few numbers, it makes it sound sort of less niche now. So it only had 145,000 accounts. These are people that have an account that subscribe to either buy software or look at their software, some free software available. The company is called Orbix, O-R-B-X. Orbix Simulation Systems. And of the 145,000 accounts, when you start to drill into the numbers, you soon find that the heavy users make up most of the revenue from this business. So we found out that last year, this is before we invested in it, about 30,000 of those users actually spent the majority of the money with the company. That generated about $6 million in revenue. The company made about $4 million in profit from the $6 million in revenue. So it was a hugely profitable business, but it wasn't really scaling along. And when Wilson's brought it to us, they were saying, if you can make it a bigger business, help the entrepreneurs, put the right executive team in, corporatize the business, you know, maybe even double the size of it, bring it to market, we'd love to list it. And it could be an amazing business. But we were still kind of stuck in this sort of niche platform. Anyway, we invested in the company. It's a really interesting business. We've appointed a new CEO into the business at the founder's wishes right from the start. She's doing a great job. And what happened, which could turn it into a really amazing opportunity, is that shortly after we invested in it, we were at the flight simulation conference in Orlando, and Microsoft came out with this new launch. They came out and said that they're going to launch their own simulator to the market. And they weren't launching a simulator to the hobby market or the pilots that were flying these simulators. They were going to launch it into a game and put it into Xbox. So that takes your niche market from, you know, we thought there was about 8 million simulators sold globally, of which we had 145,000 accounts, to potentially up to 80 million Xbox gamers that might want to fly this simulator. And Microsoft spending, so they say, in the rumors, potentially up to $100 million building this thing. And we have the scenery and detailed imagery and the skills that can help them launch their product. So they focus on building the simulator, and we, you know, work as a value-added partner to them to make their planes fly through, you know, amazing looking real life cities and regions. And I think if you go to the website at Orbix, you'll see the latest product we just released was Florida Keys. It's amazing. You just see the demo videos on how much quality of flying across the Florida Keys, and that particular product is selling like hotcakes. So when Microsoft see the sort of stuff we do, they go, yeah, that's what we want the whole world to look like. Could that one be the next, you know, Nearmap or some sort of amazing company that lists on the ASX? We hope so, but we've probably got another 12 months working, you know, in the private sense with that company and building it into something so that we can, you know, hopefully bring it to the Australian ASX and see where it goes from there.
Sounds like a fascinating opportunity. I can't wait to learn more when a prospectus comes out. That's the main part of our interview, but I've got a handful of favourite questions that I like to ask each one of my guests. So we'll get cracking into those now. The first one, could you share with us something that you've read or listened to or watched recently? Could be a book, article, research, Netflix, even a podcast that really impressed you or really blew you away.
I've been pretty interested in the coronavirus, what's going on there, and trying to understand. You know, everyone always wonders, you know, is China telling the full story? You know, is it 10,000? Is it 100,000? Is it 4 million people that are infected with this? But I was pretty interested early days to see, you know, to watch every YouTube video I could find of news offerings all around the world to see what different countries were saying about it. And I actually did that again last night just to get the latest update, you know, because you're hearing now with Iran and, you know, Singapore have got certain views, and now it's going into Italy, and, you know, how the Canadians are talking about it, et cetera. But, you know, what does that mean for the world? But I think, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see how those sort of global supply chains, how the US reacts to it, how the big European countries react to, you know, their reliance on manufacturing in China and import-export. So, you know, that's the one that sort of, you know, like many people in the world are scratching their heads trying to work out, is it a real effect to us or not? And I guess, you know, we'll find out. As I said, I think it'll eventually sort of work its way through to most countries. Hopefully it stays out of Australia for a bit longer, but, you know, hopefully the health professionals can get on top of it and we can see this as a sort of a shorter term blip rather than a longer term epidemic, as they're calling it.
Certainly hope so. But I guess, as you said, just have to wait and see at this point. If you could go back in time to when you were finishing school or university and give your younger self a single piece of investing advice, what would it be?
Look, I think it's definitely don't put all your eggs in one basket. We all learn in time with experience that businesses don't always point in the one direction all the time, and having a good, safe mix of investments across a portfolio that you can see that, you know, one or two good investments will keep those troubled investments at bay is probably the thing. You know, at university we had a great time investing in some of the, you know, what they would call penny dreadfuls and mining stocks and those sorts of things on the ASX. And we learnt a lot doing it, but we didn't make much money because, you know, it was all in or nothing. But, you know, you got to cut your teeth somewhere.
Now, before I get into my final question, I always like to insert a little bit of a disclaimer. Don't try this at home. We're not actually suggesting to anybody that they go out there and put all of their money in a single stock and forget about it for 5 years, especially given the previous comment on diversification. So this is supposed to be a bit of an exercise in long-term thinking and hopefully a little bit of fun. But with that being said, if the markets were going to close for the next 5 years, starting from tomorrow, and you could only own shares in a single company, what would it be?
Look, I'd pick a defensive stock. I think as much as I, you know, we all like the big wins, I think you'd probably pick something that, is definitely not going to disappear. So, and I'm not that I'm picking the biggest company on the ASX, but CSL would probably be the one that I'd pick to be a sort of safe haven, you know, defensive, but still carries, you know, a good amount of growth for the size of the company. So something like that I would probably pick, just because, you know, you understand, well, one, it's a great Australian success story. It's become the biggest, you know, company over the last 20 years. And I think it'd be a pretty safe place to park all the money if that was your only choice.
Great. Well, Mike, thanks so much for coming on the show today. It's been great to hear about this borderline between public and private markets, and to get your thoughts on the whole kind of sector.
No problem at all. Thank you very much for having me.